Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we're kicking off our celebration of the International Year of Family Farming. Jamie and Kenny Mote give us a full tour of their Progress Dairy Farm and explain just what makes their Jersey cows produce such sweet milk. The Motes are famous for having revived Creole cream cheese back in the 1990s, but in case you don't have access to their delicious product, I'll teach you how to make your own. Then, one of America's most famous farmers, Virginia farmer Joel Salatin, who's often described as the high priest of the pasture, visits to talk about life on Polyface Farm. We're down on the farm and out in the kitchen on this week's Louisiana Eats. Jamie and Kenny Mote have been an invaluable part of the farmers market community since they first decided to direct market their milk in 1999. It's also worth mentioning that it was Jamie and Kenny who brought Creole cream cheese back from near extinction. Along the way, there have been many ups and downs, but things are definitely on the upswing now. Recently, we got to visit the Progress Milk Barn, their Mississippi home place, and the location of their new dairy operation. I'm so excited that I got to come out to visit you all on your home place and in your new facility, because y'all even have a new name you're marketing your product under.
We do. It's called the Progress Milk Barn. And that's where we live.
We live in a little community of Progress, Mississippi. So we felt like Progress is what we want to do. That's what we need to make.
Well,
you know?
Having visited the original property and how y'all first started processing Creole cream cheese, et cetera, I can see the progress. And so we're in the room where all of the processing goes on. Kenny, would you walk us through the process of exactly how Creole cream cheese is made?
What we do is we heat our milk up. We pasteurize it, separate the cream out of it. We take the skim milk and put it in 250-gallon vats that we have, add our starter cultures to it. One day, let it set overnight, come in the next morning, dip the whey out off of it, and then ladle the curd into the cups that we let it drain in. It's kind of our choice how much we want to let it drain. We'll let it drain for a day or two, and then we'll take it from those cups and package it in a finished container where we add the cream that we separated from the milk, and we take our whole milk and add it back to it.
So it's really a 2 to 3 day process just to make a Creole cream cheese.
It is. Sometimes it takes 2 to 3 days, sometimes 4.
How many units approximately are you all making a week?
Right now we're making between 600 and 700 units a week.
Tell me a little bit, if you don't mind, about the various pieces of equipment and what they do.
Okay, the first piece of equipment here is a 50-gallon vat pasteurizer, which was the original piece of equipment that we started back with. The next piece is the cream separator that we use to actually separate the cream out of the milk that we make the skim with the Creole cream cheese, and then we also do a low-fat milk. The next piece is a new pasteurizer that we just purchased here several months ago, and it's larger. It's 130-gallon. And then the next piece is our chill vat that we use to chill milk down in, or we use it to chill water in. And then we have our cheese press that we do some of our little fresh hard cheeses in. And then over we have our Creole cream cheese that was actually dipped this morning.
They're in what appears to be old-fashioned kind of molds. What's up with that?
There was a gentleman, John Teche, that bought all of those moles from Borden's in Jackson. And my dad and him actually met and found out when we were fixing to get started making Creole cream cheese that he had these moles. And John was a big gun enthusiast, old antique guns. And my dad had an old gun, and actually they traded the gun for the moles, and that's how we got the Creole cream cheese moles.
Well, that was one good deal, huh?
Yes, it was.
I'm really fascinated to hear your latest projects about making hard cheeses. So what other kind of cheeses are you all experimenting with out here?
Right now we're actually making a farmhouse cheddar that it's not an aged cheese, it's just a fresh cheddar that we add jalapenos to it or sun-dried tomatoes. We do a fromage blanc also that we add chives, garlic, and herbs to. And what we're wanting to is to get into doing some mole-ripened cheeses, wash-rind cheeses, and doing some hard-aged cheeses.
Other than the grocery store and the farmers markets, who else is buying your product?
We have several restaurants in the city. We have some of John Besh's restaurants that is using it. Coquette is using it. Cafe Amelie, they're using it. Dominique is using it.
And then, you know, I was so lucky that I got to ride along with my favorite culinary consultant on Louisiana Eats, because we got Chef Ryan Hughes to come along, too. And so, Chef, what are you using it for?
I was raised up in Midwest, you know, in Ohio. And on my father's side of the family, they had cows and they had a small dairy there. And we knew it then before is clabbered milk, which was interesting, and I never put that together with the Creole cream cheese. And then with my pastry upbringing as a French pastry chef, we called it fromage blanc. So many chefs, you know, in New Orleans and even outside of New Orleans, we're purchasing fromage blanc separately on the side. We're not even putting two and two together that there's this amazing, wonderful product right here on the North Shore that we can get and we can use ourselves. And there's so many things we can do with it, from desserts to finishing sauces and soups with it. You know, it's absolutely amazing.
And what is different, Chef, about using the Motte's heavy cream than using other products on the market?
Well, heavy cream is a tricky thing. And I guess from having the pastry background, learning that the different percentages of milk fat in them, you know, that we're used to, 36%, 38% and whatnot, that we get from our regular suppliers is different than yours. Is that correct?
Our percentage is running better than 40%.
So he's got a 40% milk fat content in his heavy cream. And, you know, and especially like we were talking about with your butter, too, the same thing.
The cows that you all mostly like to deal with are Jersey cows, and that has a lot to do with the butter content, right?
It does. The Jersey cows, their butter fat content in the milk can run anywhere from 4.5% to 5%. So you're getting a lot more cream in a gallon of our milk compared to what you're traditionally been used to working with. Our butter is made with pure cream and nothing else. So we get a lot more of a fat content in our butter than what you would in a lot of your other butters.
And one of the elements that's causing that beautiful rich color and the butter fat in your products, it has to do with the fact that all of those happy girls are grass-fed, right?
Right, they are. We put a lot of emphasis on our grass program, and that is one reason why we lean more toward the little Jersey cow, because she is more of a grass-based cow than any of the other breeds.
Where can people find your Creole cream cheese now and your milk and cream, that gorgeous cream?
Well, you can find us at all of the Rouse's in New Orleans area and at the Crescent City Farmers Market. But we're also on the North Shore in Covington every Saturday, and we're all the way north to Jackson.
Well, you know, I'm really curious about that Jackson thing, because I
don't imagine the Jackson folks knew what Creole cream cheese was.
There's a lot of transplants, actually, in the Jackson area since Katrina. And then when they find us, we know it because they'll call us and they'll order like 10 to 15 Creole cream cheese. But the local people weren't quite as familiar with it, even though that was the last place it was made commercially.
When Borden was still doing it.
Right. But if we explain to them exactly what it is, then they'll tell us that was just like the clabber that they ate at their grandma's house on their cornbread.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that interesting?
It is. It
so
really
in Mississippi,
is.
They ate it on cornbread, and in Louisiana, we eat it on French bread.
I think that is just wonderful.
So before we walked into where the processing room is, there is this really charming little space. And it looks like you got a little retail business going here. What's this about?
We do. We have all of our neighbors actually come and get their milk. And they'll come and it's kind of an honesty policy here. Or if a lot of our customers want to come out and see the farm. And we have some of our old nostalgic pictures of when our children were showing calves, or Kenny's dad's first milk truck, the Woodlawn Dairy, that delivered milk door to door. We've got an old strainer. We actually, my aunt brought us an old fudgesicle maker that came out of New York. We have some old creamers from his grandmother who lived to be 100. The metal strainers there are the original Creole cream cheese molds that have been given to us over the years from customers that said, I found this, my mama had it from when they used to make it themselves in their kitchens.
I had no milk and butter since that cat been gone.
When we come back from a short break, we'll go out into the pasture with Kenny Mote to meet those lovely Jersey cows. Stay tuned.
All this milking.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Then we moved out into the fields to visit with those beautiful Jersey cows and learn why they produce such sweet, delicious milk. Can you tell me a little bit about your grass planting activities and how that all rolls out during the course of a year?
Well, I guess we could start with the fall of the year where we're at right now. What we generally do is we plow and plant a winter rye and oat mix, and we shoot to plant this somewhere around the middle of September, 1st of October. Then that will give, if we get the rains, we can start grazing somewhere around the week of Thanksgiving. Then according to the winter that we have, we can have fresh green grass all winter long up until the middle to the end of May is when those winter grasses will mature and go dormant. Well, then comes in our summer grasses, which is our Bermuda grass and our Bahia grasses, and they're native grasses to this region and will come up on their own whenever the temperatures get warm in the spring of the year. And usually by the 1st of May, the middle of May, those grasses will come in and we'll start grazing them until the the fall of the year whenever they'll go dormant.
Now, what is so special about that winter grass plant that you do? What is the result that you get from the milk from that?
Well, we actually have had customers that have come to the market and asked us what we were doing different with our milk in the winter months. And all it was that we were grazing ryegrass at that time, and it actually puts a little sweeter taste in the milk compared to the summer grasses that we have. The ryegrass is a wider blade leaf, and it stores more carotenes in it, and when the cow eats it, it actually transfers through into her milk and that.
And so it's the carotene that makes it golden.
It's the carotenes that make it golden, gives it the color.
That's fantastic. So then how would you describe the difference then in the summer milk?
The summer milk does not have quite the yellow tint to it, mm-hmm, because of those types of grasses. They're not able to store up as much of the carotenes, and that is what the winter grasses do. So you lose a little bit of that sweetness in your milk in the summertime. So we tell people that our milk changes with the seasons.
Well, I find this just to be incredibly interesting. If anybody is listening in, say, the Northeast, where they're quite accustomed to a completely different cycle, right?
Right. Up in the Northeast, during their winter months, they're haying and silage feeding and not feeding grass because they're not able to like we are here in the South.
And then they make a really big deal about that first milk in the spring. I think I've seen butter that's even marked that way.
I think they do, because in the springtime, after coming out of a snowy winter, their spring grasses are so lush and green, and that's probably why they make such a big deal out of it.
Kenny, how long have you and Jamie been on this property?
We have been here for 33 years.
33 years. Mm-hmm. When y'all moved here, how old were the girls?
They were only 2 and 3 years old.
And so how did y'all manage with the milking? Because how long does the milking operation take?
It was taking us at that time about 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And Jamie would take the girls. We had a playpen that we put down in the barn where we milked at. And she used to put the girls in there. And they would, in the morning times, they'd go back to sleep. And they'd sleep while we were in there milking. In the afternoon, sometimes they would stay in there if the weather was cold. Or in the summer times, a lot of time they'd get out here in front of the barn and play in the water hose and all that. So
I guess it's a little surprise that those girls have ended up right here on the farm dairying with you, huh?
Yep, that's exactly right. This is where they have been for a long time, so.
Well, I'd like to go meet your other girls, the girls who get milked every day. How
All
about
right,
that?
Sounds good.
All right, thanks, Kenny.
All right.
So, Jamie, this is actually the milking parlor.
That's right. This is it. This is where we do the milking.
And tell me how it works.
We have 16 machines in here, and they're run by vacuum. So when you turn them upside down, you turn their valve on, you get a suction through the vacuum. And you put it on one teat at a time on the cows. This here is the feeding system, and it's run through an auger, and the feed is augered to each feeder for the cows. We pull them when they come in. When you pull the first one, it's run by a motor, and then it'll fill all the feeders up for the next bunch of cows.
So the girls get fed and milked at the same time?
They do. They do. At this point, we're wanting to get away from the grain, but the only time we feed them grain is while we milk. But these cows are bred to milk very heavy, and that's just what we did as Americans over the years, to get as much milk out of that girl as we could. So it takes a lot to maintain her body. So that's why we're not ready to go strictly grass yet.
And how does it work as far as their yield goes, in the difference between the fall and winter and the spring. How many? It's pounds.
Pounds. We measure it still by pounds. You know, most Americans measure it by gallons. But we generally pick up in our milk in the fall and the winter because of our grazing. We're kind of opposite here in the South of most places. We get our best grazing in the winter time through our ryegrass and our oats. So they'll pick up 10 pounds a cow. So they'll go from 40 pounds to over 50, depending on the breed, yeah. Which is about 6 gallons.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, about 6 gallons of milk per cow.
And how long does it take for the cow to get milked?
Well, when we bring in these 16, it takes us about 15 minutes for that bunch. Once winter hits, it'll take us about 20. It just depends on how much milk they're giving.
So now you know just why the Motte's milk tastes so good. I'm Poppy Tooker, and even though they're located in Mississippi, Progress Dairy is real Louisiana Eats.
You're the cream in my coffee, you're the salt in my food. You will always be my necessity, I'd be lost without you.
In the late 1990s, Creole cream cheese had become almost extinct in its southern Louisiana birthplace. When Slow Food New Orleans was founded in 1999, Creole cream cheese was the first endangered food the local chapter nominated for revival on the International Arc of Taste, where it was accepted and promoted worldwide for its important local cultural significance. At the same time, home cooks began making it themselves, a relatively easy process that yields incredibly delicious results. To make your own Creole cream cheese, in a stainless steel or glass bowl, combine a gallon of skim milk with a cup of buttermilk. Add 6 to 8 drops of liquid vegetable rennet, the coagulating ingredient in cheese making, which can be easily purchased in health food stores. Then cover the bowl loosely with a tea towel or piece of plastic wrap and let it sit out on your kitchen counter at room temperature for 18 to 24 hours. At this point, you'll have a single large curd floating in whey. Spoon large pieces of the curd into pint-sized molds. And I make my own cheese molds by poking drainage holes into plastic deli containers using a soldering iron. Place the filled pint containers on a rack in a pan in your refrigerator to continue draining for an additional 6 to 8 hours. Your perfect little Creole cream cheeses will then be ready to turn out of the molds and store in airtight containers refrigerated for up to 2 weeks. When you're ready to eat your Creole cream cheese, just top it with a little milk or cream and sprinkle it with sugar in the French tradition. The German dairy farmers of the 19th century liked theirs savory style, sprinkled with salt and pepper. It can be used just like sour cream or creme fraiche. For a copy of this recipe, visit our website at LouisianaEatsRadio.com. Experiment with your Creole cream cheese in sweet and savory styles, and please let us know the results. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Pumpkin pie, who not ready, holler, that's a game we used to play, yeah, hide and seek who was his name at
Dr. Gourmet, our Louisiana Eats medical consultant, always has some edible good medicine for us in his bag. Tim, a prescription we often hear, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Now, what's up with that?
Well, I hope not too much, Poppy, because I might be out of business. But actually, it is sort of true. There's some really great research out there, both in the test tube, where they have mashed up apples and they've seen how those apples react to certain things like tumor necrosis factor and all these, you know, tumor markers and inflammatory agents. And the apple, you know, the mashed up apple does seem to reduce that inflammatory capability, at least in the test tube. Now, there's not a lot of research about that, you know, for us in vivo, as we say, or in humans.
Yes.
But there is great, you know, epidemiologic or what we call observational research, where when you look at people who eat more apples, more fruit, they have much lower rates of heart disease, stroke, even cancers. And it doesn't take a lot. So in the Mediterranean diet research that you and I have talked about before, for men, it's about more than 8.9 ounces of fruits or nuts per day, fruits per day, or about 7.8 ounces for women. And that's not a lot. That's one great big Honeycrisp apple. So, and it looks like that probably reduces your risk of disease by about 10%. So, you know, maybe an apple a day does keep the doctor away.
Well, I hope it doesn't keep you away. Please come back and visit with us soon.
It's great to be with you always, Poppy.
Our Louisiana Eats doctor on call, Dr. Gourmet, Tim Harlan.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching.
You'll see some things in these wonderful traditions that resonate with your own traditions or make you understand how your family became the way it is now. So I think it's an opportunity to reflect and to really understand that each and every family tradition is precious. And again, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
That's Mamie Gasparez, Executive Director of the Herman Grima House. Located a block off Bourbon Street in the French Quarter, this historic Creole townhouse has preserved its antebellum interior, allowing guests to glimpse the 1830s by passing through its doors. Today, we're visiting the Herman Grima House to see their open hearth kitchen, located at the back of the property. It illustrates how modern kitchen appliances have evolved over the past two centuries. Mamie, this is such a special and unusual place, having an opportunity to see how cooking was actually done long, long way back in the early 1800s and before. Describe what's in this open hearth kitchen, and I guess we have to start with the hearth.
I would definitely think we should start with the hearth. We do have some magnificent examples of the highest quality of kitchen utensils and implements during this time. Early in the morning, the fire would have been lit here in this large open hearth, and then the fire tended all day long by one particular servant or an enslaved worker, probably a child. One of the newfangled contraptions that made life a little bit easier for those folks who were cooking here is this, what was called a crane. So rather than a large construction crane, this of course swings on a hinge and extends out so that you and I can go ahead and get our hot water without having to stick our heads in the fire.
Yes. Those period dresses must have been a real hazard.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. Burns. I mean, just even in the opportunities that we've had to cook in here in demonstration, I know that I've hurt myself. I haven't caught my own clothing on fire, but I know that it does happen, and it is a very real and very dangerous risk. You know, in this kitchen, you can see a few things. Of course, you do see, in case the fire marshal's listening, a real fire extinguisher, but the means of extinguishing a fire during that time would be that woolen blanket that's folded in the corner, this large bucket that would have been full of water, and of course, so just some of the things that you would do, because you know that you have to be so prepared during this time, because it is a very dangerous prospect. So in this kitchen, in this open hearth kitchen, you can fry, you can saute, you can do a number of things. You can grill things. There's a griddle here. But you can also take your coals down hearth. So the white hot or clear coals would come. You take a shovel. I don't usually use a shovel in my own kitchen, but you do here. And you take the coals down hearth, and you set one of these cast iron pots with little legs and then this lid that's on the top that has a big lip. So you put coals underneath and you put coals on top. What's in there, you could bake a cake in literally 30 minutes. So it creates a convection and it cooks very well and very deliciously.
The first convection oven.
Exactly. So we're right next to the beehive oven, or as all the school children always say, look, you have a pizza oven. Okay, well, it does look just like that. But one of the unique parts of that is that, again, you have a shovel or a pizza peel, as the kids say, and you would have put the coals in the oven and then go ahead and throw some flour in, and when it turns brown, you know that your oven is ready for baking. You can put your pies, breads, anything else in there. I'm pretty sure the Hermans didn't have a big pizza dinner, but the kids love to do that. So it's very unique, but it creates a lot of heat. I should note that this is, while cooking is fun, and I agree wholeheartedly it is, it was a dangerous proposition. Burns were the second leading cause of death, right behind childbirth in the 19th century. So there were hazards of this work.
And how did people know when things were cooked? How would they know, for instance, when it was time to take the lid off of the pot?
You know, that's an interesting thing. While the Hermans had all of these amazing gadgets and modern conveniences, you really were forced to depend upon all of your senses. You might taste something, but you might really pay attention to how it looked and how it smelled. So you know whether you're actually destroying what you're cooking or it's not quite done. So it isn't just a matter of practice makes perfect. Sometimes the fire's high, sometimes it's not. Sometimes the wood is wet, sometimes it's green. It's all different. And the humidity is a big part of that too.
Maybe there's all sorts of utensils on this beautiful old wooden table. What are some of the things that people might be familiar with or not? I see a mortar and pestle.
Right, and I know that pretty much everybody has one of those. It's great for grinding and making a nice filet. And, of course, we have the bay leaves that are right here that you can grind herbs and work. The coffee grinder is one of my favorites. We have a spider pot that goes along with that where you'd roast your green coffee beans and then grind them in this. Now, remind you, at the same time, you have your hot water boiling over the hearth, and then we have the French drip pot. So if you think about having some coffee in the morning, it's quite a lot of work to get that first cup of coffee. We have so many things that only the fanciest and most sophisticated of kitchens would have had in 1831. This is a magnificent house. And a fine example of federal architecture designed by a Virginia architect, William Brand, with the finest of building materials that you could have bought. Sam Herman had made his fortune, and he spent it well. But it has all the elements of an urban plantation, the outbuildings, the stables. The original house actually extended from, the original property actually extended from St. Louis through the block all the way to Conti and then over to Dauphine. It really was a massive working property where many people lived and made their homes for many generations.
That's Mamie Gasparez, executive director of the Herman Grima House, a historic museum home located in New Orleans' French Quarter. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Do you know the origins of Creole cream cheese? When we come back from the next short break, we'll answer that question and examine the comparison between the 19th and 21st century versions. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. This week's culinary quiz, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute, is all about Creole cream cheese. Before pasteurization and refrigeration, fresh milk would naturally clabber in the mostly hot temperatures of South Louisiana. Those thrifty Creoles would take that clabbering milk, put it in cheesecloth, and hang it in the shade of the ancient oak trees until it formed a single soft curd cheese. Today, all fresh milk is legally required to be pasteurized, so liquid vegetable rennet is added to make the fresh milk clabber. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. In 1961, William and Lucille Salatin moved their young family to Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, purchasing the most worn-out, eroded, abused farm in the area, naming it Polyface Farm. Using nature as a pattern, they and their children began the healing and innovation that now supports three generations. Today, their son Joel is considered one of America's most progressive farmers because of his innovative practices at Polyface Farm. In this, the year of international family farming, we thought a visit with Joel was in order.
You often describe yourself as a grass farmer. Would you explain that?
Well, the idea there is that grass is a crop. In our culture, you know, we worship grain. We worship tillage, the plow. People are brain damaged about grass. They think of a lawn or a golf course. But when I say grass, I'm talking about Laura Ingalls and Little House on the Prairie, where the grass was 12 feet tall and the girls couldn't stray from the cabin unless they get lost in the grass. Grass is actually an incredible biomass regenerator, solar energizer. So when we say grass, it means we really honor the place of grass in the ecosystem and the place of grass as feeding the herbivore, lamb, goat, bison, cow, in the human food chain.
So how do you go about growing this grass?
Well, we don't actually plant it very much. We just, whatever grows, grows. I mean, do they have to plant grass in the side ditches of the road? No. And yet the grass grows there and they have to mow it, you know, or it takes over everything. So the idea is to mimic the kind of herbivore movement that occurs in nature. We do have really high-tech computer microchipped electric fence. And that allows us to create a pattern or a template in this biomimicry and duplicate it on the farm to put the herbivores in the right place at the right time.
Well, you described the whole farm as being the Polyface salad bar. Could you explain that?
Well, sure. Yeah, the idea of a salad bar is that it's somebody comes in and refreshes it all the time. It's not stale. It's great if you go in to have it, but if somebody locked the door in a restaurant and said, now everybody has to stay in here for a week, you know, by the end of the week, everybody'd be down to what, vinegar, onions, and garbanzo beans, or, you know, whatever it is that you like the least in the salad bar. And so the idea of the salad bar is that we are refreshing it every day for a new paddock for the chickens and the turkeys and the cows and the pigs. They're not in a continuous occupation. They're in this grazing. And then the second thing is, of course, the appeal of a salad bar is diversity. There's a lot of different stuff there to choose from. And animals have a palatability index, just like you and I. Not only a palatability index, but a diversified menu desire. In other words, a nutritional need. And so by having the electric fencing or the electric netting or whatever it is that controls the animal to concentrate them and move them onto a fresh paddock every day, we freshen that forage for them like a salad bar. And all of that not only encourages a better blanket for the earth, for the soil, it also creates a more interesting and diversified and complete diet for the animals that are on that salad bar.
Well, let's discuss all the animals and their role. For instance, I would think that you would be the first one to say the worms might be the most important workers at your farm. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Dancing earthworms is one of my all-time best metaphors. And it all starts with the soil. You know, Sir Albert Howard, who gave to the world scientific aerobic composting, said that if you try to use artificials in the soil that make artificial plants, it makes artificial animals and then artificial people that can only be kept alive with artificials. And we can certainly see the growth of the pharmaceutical industry in our country to realize that we have, through artificials, created, in fact, a fairly artificial existence.
So it's the worms, the chickens. How do they all follow each other in this big parade you've got going on every day at Polyface?
Sure. Yeah, we call it a ballet in the pasture. So there are certain leader followers things. I mean, well, the earthworms, of course, they are living on decomposing biomass. I mean, that is part of the carbon sequestering picture. And so how does nature feed them best? It does it with perennials. And that's why all historical, even crop rotations, always had this multi-year period of a perennial pasture. So it starts with this perennial blanket, and then the animals move. The chickens follow the cows like the birds follow the, you know, the herbivores in nature. The pigs follow the cows in the hay shed in the wintertime and turn the compost, the bedding, and turn it into aerobic compost. We call them pig-orators. The turkeys go under the orchards. And the mushrooms grow in the mulch under the orchard trees, and the mycorrhizae hold the wood chips, the mulch together, so the turkeys can't scratch it out. So anyway, there's this beautiful component of all these different relational, symbiotic plant-animal relationships that actually mimic the kind of helps and cycles that nature creates.
That is really a beautiful dance. Your books have become increasingly controversial, at least with the titles. In this one, you shed special light on even American childcare. What's the problem with American kids today?
Well, for the first time in civilizational history, in human history, we now view children as a liability rather than an asset. We talk about how much it costs to grow a child, as opposed to what a child can add in value to the family. So if we go into historical normalcy, we're the first civilization that's raised the average child without chores. And, you know, think of the childhood chores that kids used to have with gardening, weeding the beans, helping mom can. These were all integral parts of growing up and incorporated children into the adult world. We have now segregated these children into a childhood of essentially non-involvement with the adult world.
Well, you had a lot of very interesting experiences that you recorded with some of your interns. Let's talk about healthy fear.
Yeah, we have noticed for a long time that when children grow up around animals, machinery, gardening, they come with a more humble approach to things. You know, if you don't water the tomato, it'll get dry and die. And you can't just snap your fingers and the video game gives you a new tomato plant. Around cows, you know, a herd of cows demands respect. You need to place yourself and be aware of what's going on. You can't just be walking around like a zombie with a bunch of tubes sticking out your ears listening to crazy music while the cows stampede over you. You've got to be situationally aware and looking out, lifting your head up and looking out. What this does to self-actualization and self-worth and the need, the reason to be, you know, reason that's for a young person to be needful in something meaningful. This isn't make work. This is real stuff. And it's extremely powerful in shaping the emotional psyche of an individual.
Some of the advice that you hammer home in the book, on more than one occasion, I have to say, is replace your parakeet with two chickens. Now, what are you talking about there?
Well, what I'm talking about is we come even to the greenie agenda. We can speak, I think, generally people know when we talk about the greenie agenda. It's a lot of things. But one of them is compost your kitchen scraps. You know, we want to take this biomass and compost it rather than landfilling it. And I'm saying, let's go beyond that. We don't even need to compost it. Let chickens fill their historically normal role as homestead, farmstead salvage operations and do the cleanup work. And so here we've got parakeets in a cage and you have to buy real special feed for them. They keep you up all night and they make a manure that's a toxic problem. Well, get rid of them. Put in two chickens. They will eat your kitchen scraps. You don't have to buy anything. You don't even have to spend the diesel fuel to put on a garbage truck to take it to a compost pile.
But how feasible?
And the chickens will lay you eggs.
How feasible is that, though, really, for city dwellers?
There are people doing it in New York City all over. They've been featured in the New York Times. The new Sheikin. It's the new Manhattan Sheikin. And absolutely, you know, the chickens aren't as loud. They're much more functional. And their manure is so non-toxic, you can use it as a side dress on your flowers and your pots in your home and as a fertilizer.
And it's really important, I think, that you have led the way in this processing your chickens on the farm.
Yes, this is all a part of reducing the mileage. You know, when you eat, you know, most Americans, when they eat their meal, they're actually eating food that's seen more of America than the farmer that grew it. We're the first civilization that's put 1,500 miles under every morsel of food. That's unsustainable. We can't do that. If fuel becomes more expensive, the whole food system floats on a barrel of oil, essentially. And when we localize it, and I mean, I'm talking about, as you know, in this book, I'm talking about serious, whether it's the chicken kitchens or whether it's using the medians of the interstate to grow pears and apples. We can localize this. And when we do, it just creates a wonderful awareness, transparency, and integrity in what becomes flesh of our flesh and bone of our bones.
Well, your normal really does make sense when you listen to the story that you're preaching. But do you believe that there's enough momentum and energy to fully bring about the changes that you're seeking in the world?
Oh, I think there's I call it a local food tsunami. We're in New Orleans. I'll call it a tsunami, not a hurricane. But people are jumping off of the Monsanto, the industrial food ship. And everybody's story is different. Sometimes it's just the taste. You know, who wants cardboard tomatoes? Sometimes it's a health issue. Sometimes it's an ecology issue. Wow, I'm going to change because what I eat today affects the landscape, the earthworms of tomorrow. And so everybody's story is different, but we are entering in our culture. We had the agrarian economy. Then we had the industrial economy. Then we had the information economy. Now we're heading into the regenerative economy. And that is a powerful confluence of factors. I'll give you young people. I do a lot of college campuses speaking, and you'd be surprised how many times I go and I'm speaking at a class and the professor says, if you don't mind, could you come a half hour early? Because the kids have made a potluck from their CSAs and their little patio gardens to come in and they want to feed you, you know? And I'm thinking, wow, where was this 30 years ago? This is a cool, cool thing. And I'm very excited about it.
Well, you know, everybody accuses us of being slow in the South. Why do you think this kind of farming philosophy hasn't really hit us here yet?
Well, I think the main reason the South is a little slow on this, and you can track my speaking engagements to know that I definitely go north more than south and out into the San Francisco Bay Area. I think it's because the South doesn't have the hard winters to drive people indoors to sit by the crackling fire and read and think about the why. In the South, you know, we can work all the time. We're doing the how, you know, and we're working what's called in the business and not working on the business. And it could be just as simple as that.
That's Joel Salatin, the High Priest of the Pastures at Virginia's Polyface Farm. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima and Lady Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original music provided by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh
consulting producer Margaret Howes, and sound engineers Guy Mulladew and Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.